What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Rabbi Daniel Freelander, the president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. There was a great post last week from a recent guest of Too Jewish, Rabbi Benjamin Blech, in which he talked about physicist Stephen Hawking. Hawking's personal story is the subject of the fine new film, The Theory of Everything, an Oscar contender. Diagnosed in 1963 with Lou Gehrig's disease, the dreaded ALS, and given 2 years to live, Stephen Hawking went on to a brilliant career, became the author of international bestsellers, including A Brief History of Time, and has gained broad recognition as the most brilliant theoretical physicist since Einstein.
It has been a great joy to watch this man defy every expectation, both scientific and personal.
There should be no boundaries to human endeavor. However bad life may seem, while there is life, there is hope.
Stephen Hawking, who speaks with a mechanical voice and has persevered through challenges that would have felled most ordinary men, clearly is not daunted by personal fears. Yet in a recent interview, he confided that he was deeply concerned for the future of humanity. The cause of that concern is artificial intelligence, or AI, the design and creation of intelligent machines that are able to outthink us, their creators. What began with IBM's Watson supercomputer, capable of handily beating chess grandmasters, may in the near future, Stephen Hawking warned, checkmate its designers and become Earth's ruler. The development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race, Hawking said. Science fiction has prepared us for that. Films like 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Terminator, and The Matrix series pit puny humans against AI-driven enemies. The upcoming Avengers movie depicts superheroes forced to battle Ultron, an AI machine determined to destroy humanity. Interestingly, as computers have leapt forward in every way, from speed to capacity to reliability to connectivity to integration, artificial intelligence has remained a stubbornly elusive goal. While we can make machines that are almost infinitely more capable and useful and addictive, we've had a very hard time getting them to think independently or intelligently. But Hawking's fear of real AI computing may now be legitimate. Apparently, breakthroughs have finally taken place. We'll be able to truly create AI machines in the near future. But there's a world of difference between the ability to create and the power to control those creations. As Google's director of engineering Ray Kurzweil said, it may be hard to write an algorithmic moral code strong enough to constrain and contain super smart software. The greatest danger of scientific progress is the possibility that what we bring into being realizes a life of its own and is no longer subservient to its maker or to human values. There are always unanticipated consequences. Well, that's the message of the famous legend of the Golem of Prague, the basis for most fictional depictions of magical science gone wrong. In Jewish tradition, the Maharal, Rabbi Yehuda Low, the 16th century rabbi of Prague, used his knowledge of Kabbalistic mysticism to magically animate a lifeless homunculus of clay and turn it into a superhuman defender of the Jewish people. On the golem's forehead, he wrote the Hebrew word for truth, emet, which mystically gave the creature its power. Much to his consternation, the Maharal soon realized that once granted its formidable strength, the golem became impossible to control. Versions of the story differ, but in every one, the golem gets beyond the rabbi's ability to control it and must be destroyed. The rabbi therefore reaches up and erases the first letter of the Hebrew word emet, the aleph, which has a numerical value of 1, representing the one God who alone gives life. That leaves only the 2 letters spelling the Hebrew word for death, mate. No longer representing the will of the ultimate true creator, the golem returns to the dust that it was. You know, it was the legend of the golem that inspired Mary Shelley to write Frankenstein, about the ultimate unorthodox scientific experiment that creates life but then goes terribly wrong. Many comic book superheroes, from Superman and the Hulk to the X-Men, have been based on the golem tale. The lesson of the golem is that creation without control is a formula for catastrophe. The history of scientific achievement testifies that progress detached from morality leads to disaster. It is what grants us the knowledge to penetrate the secrets of nuclear fission, but at the cost of placing humanity in danger of universal annihilation. It is what teaches us how to build tiny bombs and then use them to slaughter children. It is what gives us the capacity to coordinate terror networks through Facebook. And remember, always, the most advanced nation in the world in scientific knowledge in the 1930s was Nazi Germany. Today, well, it might be us here in America, and it just might be China. The story of the Golem of Prague is a parable of the hazards of permitting what we create to go beyond our intent. Artificial intelligence has many advantages, yet super smart software in an AI machine cannot really think as we humans are supposed to think. Machines do not have moral sensitivity. They don't share the ethical limitations of their programmers. A truly intelligent machine and its software are not restricted by the values of those who brought them into being. Think of the movie Her last year. It starred an operating system that appeared to care, voiced by Scarlett Johansson, who is Jewish. The operating system entered into a romantic, loving relationship with a human, but actually was equally involved with thousands of other humans and ended the relationships as soon as there was a software update. Stephen Hawking has done us a favor by alerting us to the potential dangers of AI. In a way, God could have used that warning when we humans were first created, for we have proven to lack the consistent ability to use our own intelligence for good. Interestingly, Hawking has publicly admitted that he is an atheist. In response to a journalist questioning him about his religion, he said unequivocally, "There is no God." But it seems likely that the God in whom I and much of the world believe also regrets the artificial intelligence with which humanity is imbued. We ourselves are the greatest illustration of the fear we now verbalize for our technology. Creations capable of destroying our world and other creatures, because we ourselves lack the moral foundation that originates with belief. It is this message that resonates in our Torah again and again. We human beings, of course, have moral limitations and a capacity for great evil, but each of us also has a choice that could lead us instead to goodness and blessing, if we seek and find the ethical commandedness that Judaism reveres. Artificially intelligent machines, like us artificially intelligent humans, may ultimately learn to choose to be good, you know, like we can. That choice is, as the prophet Micah teaches us, to learn how to do justice, to love mercy, and to learn to walk humbly with God. It's a great lesson and a great reminder for our future artificial intelligences and for our own today. To play us in this morning, here's a beautiful arrangement of Danny Meseng's setting of Elohai Nitzor, "My God, Guard My Speech from Evil," as performed by Pink Martini.
Elohai Nitzor, Loshoni Meira, Usfatai Midaber Mirma, Valim Kalelai, Nafshi Titom, Nafshi Keafala Koti Elohai. Elohai. Elohai Nitzor, Loshoni Meira, Usfatai Midaber Mirma, Vilim kalelai nafshi titom, v'nafshi ke'afal hakol tiye Elohai. Elohai. Elohai nitzor l'shoni mera, u'sfatai midaber mirma.
von dem Kallelein auf Schietidom, von auf Schiekerfall, kommt die Elohai, Elohai.
That was composer and cantor Danny Meseng's beautiful Elohai Netzor, as performed by the group Pink Martini. While here in America, we often focus solely on what we know of Jewish practice and culture locally, progressive Judaism continues to flourish all around the globe, in every climate and many countries. The World Union for Progressive Judaism is the parent organization for most of the non-Orthodox synagogues around the world, including Israel, and we'll welcome our good friend, Rabbi Danny Freelander, the new president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, when we return soon here on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish a good friend, Rabbi Danny Freelander. He is the head of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, the president of the organization of all Reform congregations around the world outside of North America. Danny was previously the senior vice president of the Union for Reform Judaism and has served Reform Judaism in many important ways, including musical ways, over his long terms of service. I don't want to make you sound old. You're not. Welcome and mazel tov on your new position.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sam.
Tell us a little bit about the situation of the World Union right now, how it stands in relationship to growth and in its position in the world.
Well, the world, the Jewish world, is changing radically and quickly. If you look at the Jewish world sort of as a barbell, you'll see 6.5 million Jews in North America, 6.5 million Jews in Israel, and about 2.5 million Jews spread out throughout the rest of the world. And those of us listening on the radio today probably know an awful lot about North American Jewry and about Israeli Jewry, but very little about the incredible diversity of Jewish experiences around the world. The World Union for Progressive Judaism is primarily concerned with making sure there is a pluralistic Jewish choice, a Jewish alternative voice, anywhere in the world where there are Jewish communities. So we are, first of all, not primarily concerned with Jewish survival, but we're concerned with Jewish vibrancy, with how we create meaningful, powerful Jewish communities where individuals who feel Jewish, who were born Jewish, who want to associate with Judaism, can feel comfortable. So we're in a period of growth in certain parts of the world and of reorganization in other parts of the world.
You know, I think that people don't have a very strong feel for the real diversity of liberal Judaism around the world. Reform congregations in Australia are not necessarily akin to World Union congregations in Eastern Europe, for example. How do you bridge all those kinds of gaps?
Well, it's fascinating to me as I move from community to community to realize how radically different Reform Judaism plays itself out in different communities. Those of us speaking today have probably been to several synagogues, Reform synagogues in North America, and we are very conscious of how different they are from one another, how different they feel from one another. But now, even when I travel between, oh, say, Belarus, where I was a couple of weeks ago, or Australia, where our leadership visited this month, or Argentina, where I'll be visiting at the end of December, Reform Judaism plays out very, very differently. And it's not only in the style of worship, but it's in the liturgy itself, it's in the prayers itself, it's where we are on the Jewish spectrum, how radically Reform or radically traditional the various communities are. It's also very clear to me that in those communities where there are no other non-Orthodox choices, where it's either Chabad or Progressive Judaism, that the Reform congregation, the Reform movement, tends to be a very centrist movement, probably far more akin to what we'd know in the United States and Canada as Conservative Judaism. But in those communities where there is a spectrum, the Reform community tends to be far more liberal, and that's, I think, a healthy thing. In each community, Reform has become an alternative, making sure there are pluralistic Jewish voices.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Danny Freelander, the president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. We come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have 3 stores. We're opening a 4th in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts.
We welcome our Mivi non Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson, Arizona. Boker Tov, Oshrat, and Happy New Year, secularly.
Boker Tov, Rabbi, and Shana Tova.
Shana Tova. We've talked a great deal about the various institutions of Israel. Let's talk about the people of Israel this morning.
Sure. I found the very interesting figure from the Statistic Bureau in Israel that says that 57, according to 2012, 57% of the Israelis were born in Israel.
So 57% of Israelis are now Sabras, born in Israel.
Yeah, but most of them, if not all of if not all of them, are first generation in Israel. So all of them are has an origin that came from somewhere, you know, east, west, somewhere, like in a... So it makes Israel very, very, as you can guess, very varied in terms of culture, in terms of food, in terms of music, in terms of everything, because I think it will take another 100 years or more. So it really will be a Sabra, a real Israeli culture, a real Israeli identity, less influenced by, you know, the
infusions of foreign Jews coming to Israel.
Nachon.
Question, because we think about it, Israel's now in getting into its late 60s. It's no longer a brand
still
new
young.
Nation. Yeah, still young to me, thank God, but still. And it's fascinating because, well, originally, of course, it was such a nation of immigrants. We thought that that was kind of over, and then the huge wave of Russian immigration, Ethiopians, and now we're seeing lots of European Jews, South mm-hmm. American Jews mm-hmm. coming,
yeah.
Even still some Jews from Arab countries. Will there ever really come a time when there aren't continuous flow of Jews in from the rest of the world?
I don't know. Now that I'm hearing you, and since there's still like a majority of the Jewish people are abroad, so, you know, so maybe no. Maybe we'll always be a tfutzot, Eretz shel tfutzot, which means we'll be... Well, mixed culture, you know,
a very
nation.
Polyglot culture,
yeah.
multicultural
yeah.
Israel.
And colorful culture.
There are, of course, are many advantages to having this constant infusion of talent and ideas and foods. It's one thing that made Israel such a startup nation.
Yeah, the creativity comes from, you know, different people think so differently and not like same tradition, same habits, same
way. We only do it this way.
Yeah.
So my question...
Good point.
So a very interesting culture. So the synthesis is going to be an ongoing organic process for a long
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I think so.
May it always be so.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ashrat. We'll talk next
Thank
week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Jews of France and the long history and complicated history. Last week, we talked about the large Arab immigration from Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, that occurred after the loss of the French colonies and the effect that that's had on French society. Let's talk about its impact for the Jews of France.
Okay, it's an important question because what looks to many Americans and other outsiders like anti-Semitism in France today stems largely from a group of underprivileged people who are either themselves immigrants from those three countries or the children of immigrants. And what has happened over the past couple of decades, since maybe the early 90s or the very late 80s, is that These people who initially settled in the South and performed vital jobs in the agricultural sector became more and more urbanized and became less and less employed. And as they, in many cases, didn't learn French, they became less and less employable. So they became marginalized in many ways, socially, economically, et cetera, et cetera. And in France, unlike in this country, people who live in the suburbs are the poorer people. Rich people live in the center city where they can walk everywhere and they live in beautiful apartment buildings and whatever. The poor working class suburbs of big cities like Marseille or Paris, notably, are largely poor immigrants. And today you can see it as you drive through the streets. There are certain suburbs of Paris where everybody is either African, Asian, or North African, but they're all people of color in a sense. They're all visibly different. They're not all equally disadvantaged. The least popular of these groups is, in fact, the North Africans, because they're the ones who most stubbornly resist integration. And there are large high-rises, which in French are called HLM, which is Habitation à Logement Modéré.
I believe you.
Which actually means like low-cost public housing.
Yeah.
It's subsidized housing. And there are these big high-rises with hundreds of units, which means hundreds of families. And in some cases, the families are very large. So there could be 4,000 people in one of these buildings easily. And most of those people are unemployed. And the children feel this sense of hopelessness. And they look for targets on which to take out their rage. And because it's never easy to rage against the establishment as such, the most visible targets are Jews who've been fairly successful, but were once penniless immigrants like themselves. In some cases, as recently as the 1940s. So they got a 40-year head start, but particularly the children of these North African immigrants look at the Jews and say, why do you have it so good? It's not fair. Bang, bang, bang. And there's like physical violence, racial slurs, combined with whatever they learn in the mosque about the evil state of Israel that once had French support. So it's another way of getting at French establishment via the Jews. So the vast majority of what looks like anti-Semitism in France today comes from this group of people. It is not 100%, but it's certainly well over 50%. So I consider that even if these people have French citizenship and can vote in French elections, they are a subset of French citizens and not representative of the country as a whole.
Indeed, probably true. Still concerning, of course, for French Jews and for others around the world. Tom, thanks for that great survey of the Jews of France. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. It was a terrible night cold, rain, sleet. The streets were deserted, and the local baker was about to close up when Bernie slipped through the door. He carried an umbrella blown inside out. He was bundled in two sweaters and a thick coat. But even so, he still looked wet, bedraggled, and freezing. As Bernie unwound his scarf, he said to the baker, May I have two bagels to go, please? The baker said in astonishment, Two bagels? Nothing more? That's right, answered Bernie. One for me and one for Bernice. Bernice is your wife? Asked the baker. What do you think? Snapped Bernie. My mother would send me out on a night like this? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. As this week's portion of Vayera begins, the Israelites are in Egyptian slavery, and the mysterious figure of Moses has returned to try to free them from bondage. In Vayera, God brings about a series of plagues that traumatize the Egyptians and bedevil Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Blood, frogs, lice, wild beasts, boils, and cattle disease serially afflict the land and its inhabitants, or at least the non-Israelite inhabitants. In next week's portion of Bo, four more plagues will come. Hail, locusts, and darkness, all leading up to the climactic death scene, the slaying of the firstborn, and the ultimate exodus. The great moment in which our ancestors are freed from slavery, model for narratives of deliverance and emancipation ever after. These plagues are interesting in and of themselves, however. There are three sets of three plagues each, increasing in severity and complexity, every one designed to prove the power of the true God and the impotence of the pagan gods of Egypt. The Nile River was a principal deity of Egypt, as well as the source of its life and livelihood, and so, for the first plague, God simply turns it into undrinkable blood. There are frog gods in the Egyptian pantheon, and they are next turned into pests that infest homes and fields. The scarab is a sacred beetle to Egyptians, a symbol of the pharaoh's power. Insects are thus used to torment the inhabitants, and so it goes. Sacred cows become diseased. The fertility of the land of Egypt, sacred, is destroyed. Finally, even the great Ra, the solar disk of the sun itself, is blotted out for days. The plagues are a statement of theology. There is only one God. Those who adhere to other gods and use their own power to enslave others will be overthrown with power and majesty. The arrogant will be overcome. Freedom will be guaranteed, and justice through the true God will triumph. You know, it's a message that still has resonance today. Whenever we come to believe that evil is destined to reign, that those who enslave others will rule, that those who use their control for malign purposes are destined to flourish forever, we should reread this plague's narrative here in Exodus. For, at heart, this is a universe created by God for good. When we increase justice, we are simply doing the work for which we were made. And when we return, in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Danny Freelander, the newish president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, will update us on Reform and Liberal Judaism literally all around the world.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... At Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322 322-
7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a terrible terrorist attack that did not involve either Jews or Israel, Muslim terrorists shot up the Paris office of a French satirical magazine, Charlie Hebdo, last week, murdering 12 people and wounding many others. The magazine had had the temerity to publish cartoons ridiculing ISIS, as it had previously run cartoons and satire about the Prophet Muhammad. French President François Hollande said, "No barbaric act will ever shoot down press freedom. We are a united country that can react and unite." One hopes that the response in France to this sort of horrific Islamist act is swift and complete. We will see how long it takes for Europeans to realize that Muslim extremism in one's own backyard, or front yard in this case, is nothing that can be dealt with gently. Maybe they will then begin to understand the predicament Israel is in with Hamas. In less tragic but still sad news, the Streit family announced last week it will close the doors of its 90-year-old matzah factory this spring after the 57-75 Passover baking season. The announcement was made by filmmaker Michael Levine, who has been working on a documentary about the company, Streit's Matzah and the American Dream, for the past 2 years. This closure will mark the end of an era. Since 1925, the Streit's Matzah factory has stood at 148 to 154 Rivington Street on New York's Lower East Side. Levine said, "Here in four low-slung brick tenement buildings, five generations of the Streit family and as many generations of factory workers devoted their lives to the art of mixing flour and water, sending these two simple ingredients through a 73-foot-long oven to create sheets of matzah, the unleavened bread central to the Jewish holiday of Passover." The four buildings that comprise Streit's factory, which is the last family-owned matzah factory in the U.S., are now under contract to, you guessed it, a developer. "I personally know that this was an agonizing decision for the Streit family," Levine said. "I watched as they turned down offer after offer until the challenges of maintaining a manufacturing business in a drastically changing Lower East Side, as well as the pressures of increased foreign competition, left the company no alternative but to accept. For the Jewish community nationwide, and for the descendants of immigrants of all backgrounds whose families passed through this neighborhood over the course of the last century or who remain here, it is the loss of a connection to a Lower East Side that is ever more the domain of museums and memory, not daily life," said Levine. Streit's matzah produces 40% of the matzah sold in the U.S. The family says it hopes to find a new home for the business. "In my opinion, and certainly my wife Wendy's, Streit's matzah is the best-tasting matzah and matzah meal on the market. We can only hope they find a new location for manufacturing, because as bad as matzah tastes, this is truly the very best it can be." And two deaths to report in the Jewish world, both New York-related.
There she is, Miss America. The dream of a million girls who are more than pretty can come true in Atlantic City, for she may turn out to be the queen of femininity.
Bess Meyerson, the first and so far only Jewish Miss America, died last week at the age of 90. A Bronx girl, a concert pianist who didn't have the money for college, she was entered into the 1945 Miss New York pageant by her sister without her knowledge. When she won that and then the Miss America pageant in Atlantic City, she was wildly cheered by Jews who wanted to be seen as something more than nameless victims. The announcer shouted, "Beauty with Brains, that's Miss America, 1945. Bess Meyerson discovered on her Miss America tour that there was a great deal of anti-Semitism in immediately post-World War II America. She cut the tour short, returned to New York, and agreed to embark instead on a six-month lecture tour for the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, speaking out against prejudice with a speech titled, "You Can't Be Beautiful and Hate." She became a celebrity, appeared at Carnegie Hall playing Rachmaninoff, did some vaudeville, and then began a long run on television game shows. In 1969, New York Mayor John Lindsay appointed her as consumer affairs chief for New York, a job that began a successful career in public service. Lindsay critics initially called Meyerson's appointment window dressing, but Bess Meyerson became highly successful, issuing the first city regulation in the nation requiring retailers to post unit prices on a wide variety of products to make comparison shopping easier. Bess Meyerson pushed through consumer protection laws against deceptive trade practices, recovered millions of dollars for defrauded consumers, published a book about consumer fraud, and wrote a column for Red Book. She later served three U.S. presidents on various commissions, survived cancer, and became New York Mayor Ed Koch's companion at many public events for years. Koch later appointed her to become commissioner of the Department of Cultural Affairs in New York. She became involved in a scandal, unfortunately, involving a younger man and a possibly corrupt contract, finally moved to California to live out her life quietly. Bess Meyerson, an American Jewish original.
The weather is frigid at Yankee Stadium, but there's a red-hot brand of football on display as the Giants take on Pittsburgh for the Eastern title.
And Ali Sherman, Brooklyn-born son of Russian-Jewish immigrants who started out as a left-handed quarterback at Brooklyn College and went on to take the New York Giants to the NFL title game in his first three seasons as their coach, died last week at the age of 91. Sherman's early years as a Giants coach were a revered time in the New York Giants franchise history. His players included quarterbacks Charlie Connerly and most famously Y.A. Tittle, running backs Alex Webster, Kyle Rote, and Frank Gifford, and wide receiver Del Schaffner, as well as a formidable defensive lineup including Sam Huff, Andy Robustelli, and Rosie Greer. Undersized for football, 5'10 and just 160 pounds, and unable to throw long, Sherman nonetheless lasted 5 years as a pro quarterback with the Philadelphia Eagles in the mid-40s. "I was the best left-handed ball holder on conversion kicks in the history of the NFL," he once said. Ali Sherman was a perennial backup player, but the Eagles prized him for his keen football knowledge, sharp mind, and his mastery of the T formation. Sherman blended that football intellect with an uncommon intensity in coaching the Giants to the NFL's Eastern Conference Championship in 1961, 62, and 63. His teams were beaten in the league's championship game every year, twice by the Green Bay Packers and once by the Chicago Bears, but Sherman achieved high stature in a profession that few Jews have reached. Sherman modeled his success on the revival of the T formation, which had been most successful in the hands of another Jewish quarterback, Sid Luckman, with the Bears back in the 40s. And he helped bring the New York Giants great success. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our good friend Rabbi Danny Freelander. He is the president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, the international umbrella organization of reform and also progressive, liberal, and other movements, serving 1,200 congregations with 1.8 million members in more than 45 countries. That feels almost like the UN in some ways, doesn't it?
Well, it is a UN, and there's no one common language. We find that first of all, I'm not particularly good in Portuguese.
I'm shocked.
And we're having our convention this year in Rio de Janeiro, and so I speak and I understand a little bit of Spanish, and someone who understands Spanish and Portuguese translates in their into their language. But it is a United Nations. Even in terms of understanding the texts, we here read English and some Hebrew. Well, we now realize that our brothers and sisters in Argentina and in Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo don't have any access to non-Orthodox translations and commentaries on the Torah. So in the past year, we have released a translation of the Plautz Torah commentary, the liberal Torah commentary, into Russian, and another one into German, and in April we'll complete our translation into Portuguese, and next comes French, and then comes Spanish. But we realize that unless there is access to non-Orthodox interpretations of Judaism in the local vernacular, that people are stuck with whatever they've grown up with or whatever is passed on to them. I'm frankly in awe of some of the organizations that speak many languages, but most of them are concerned with Jewish survival, not with Jewish vibrancy, and that's a real key difference. Similarly, every country and every Reform Judaism believes theirs is the true Reform Judaism.
Of course, because they're Jews, after all.
That's correct, and you know, everyone is the president of their congregation. So even in matters of conversion, we'll have two countries that share a border with Batei Din, with rabbinic groups that do conversions with different standards. And then neither one is an Orthodox Jewish standard, but all are in different places in the Reform spectrum, and they each believe that their way is the right way to do it. But I guess that's a normal situation in any Jewish community, in any Jewish organization, in any Jewish world.
It seems to me that the one commonality, besides a non-Orthodox approach to Judaism and the World Union, is a strong connection to Israel, sometimes even stronger for those non-North American congregations than for ours here. How does that translate in the World Union's activity?
Well, Israel is absolutely central to Progressive Judaism and Reform Judaism everywhere. And here in the United States, we have our own way of relating, but we have a very vibrant local Jewish infrastructure. In other parts of the world, Israel is their summer camp. Israel is their spiritual center. Aliyah and Israel learning is never far from the center. So our youth movements, for example, in England or in Poland or in Russia are far more influenced with their connection to Israel than they are with connections to other Jews in their own country or elsewhere. Their notion of Klal Yisrael, not distant from our own notion of our Jewish responsibility, is largely because between their diaspora Jewish community and the State of Israel. The international headquarters of the World Union is in Jerusalem. The bulk of our staff is in Jerusalem, and in fact, our greatest success story as a Reform Jewish movement has been the birthing of the Israeli Movement for Progressive Judaism, which we created, and the World Union built the initial 7 or 8 congregations, and now numbers over 60 communities in Israel, with many, many thousands of members and non-members coming together for the High Holidays, a reality we couldn't have dreamed of years ago. More importantly, it's now an indigenous Israeli movement, not in any way dominated by the expats that helped create Reform Judaism in Israel some 40 years ago.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of the World Union. Dick Hirsch, the legendary leader of the World Union for many years, set a powerful pattern, including that Israeli emphasis initially. There have been a lot of transitions in leadership. What's different now?
Well, Dick Hirsch was the master builder of Progressive Judaism, and he recognized that we could either be an organization that facilitated communication between Reform congregations around the world, or we could build Reform Judaism in places where Reform Judaism did not yet exist. So he moved our headquarters from New York to Israel in 1973. He built a headquarters building in Israel, and he helped get the resources to build many, many Reform congregations in Israel and help the Israeli Movement for Progressive Judaism get organized. We're now sort of like the proud parents who are handing over the reins to Israeli Reform Judaism to a new generation of Israeli Reform Jewish leaders trained in Reform and World Union organized training programs. But there's a more than a sufficient critical mass where Israel doesn't no longer need to be the center of our assistance, but rather is our partner in creating strong Reform communities around the world. So instead of us being, as North American Jews, magnanimous towards Israel, Israel is now being magnanimous towards the former Soviet Union, towards communities elsewhere in Europe, towards communities in South Africa, where they are lending human assistance and financial assistance to help build reform congregations elsewhere. So Israel remains central, but its role is far enhanced from what it has been. It's now self-sufficient, it's now vibrant, and is growing, and it's been the public awareness of the movement as well.
So a funny question, based on your tremendous musical knowledge and experience. A lot of times we Reform Jews think we can just export whatever it is we're doing right now somewhere else and it will work. As great as, you know, you and Jeff Shalom Rav is that music going to be what translates to, I don't know, Poland or South Africa?
Well, I'm really surprised as I travel the diversity of the musical styles. Where here we would rarely put a Debbie Friedman piece or a Klepper piece together with a Lewandowski or Sulzer piece, and in Central and Eastern and West and Eastern Europe, it's absolutely normal. And the second piece is not so different than the United States. Whatever is sung in the camps is assumed by the young people who go home to be normative Jewish experience. So if they sing a Klepper piece or a Debbie Friedman piece in a summer camp, they go home seeing this as traditional Jewish music, and they treat it as such. But there's no history, there's no baggage. They're not inheriting music from another generation. They're identifying through their visits to other synagogues and through their youth experience melodies that seem to resonate with them. So it's the most remarkable mishmash of music that I've ever heard, even less coherent than we hear in North America.
Yeah, I didn't know that was possible, but I'm not entirely surprised.
By the way, I had this wonderful experience where the Russians in particular are well-trained musicians.
Oh, yeah.
So the music leaders of their synagogues really know music. But they don't have a sense of musical style for popular music or folk music. So they will approach every sheet of music they get with the same operatic approach. So you can hear the most operatic Misha Berach that you've ever wanted to hear, more than you ever wanted to hear, in St. Petersburg, but it is exactly the same melody as we might sing here.
Fascinating. So this is a terrible question to ask, but what's your favorite place to visit in the World Union so far? It's only been a few months now, but I know this is probably like asking which of your children do you like better, but you know, you can have an opinion.
Well, I think I have two favorite places. One is always Israel, because things are Jewishly, you know, it's like a Jewish Disneyland. So every Jewish question I've ever asked, someone else is asking there. And there's just an energy that I find very exciting. And secondly, I'm very intrigued by Poland, where there are maybe 1,000 Jews left, but there are many thousands of individuals involved in congregational life, very few of them born Jewish or with any Jewish blood. And in Poland, we're seeing the emergence of Jewish communities almost exclusively made up of individuals who are Jews by choice, who are converts to Judaism. And they bring a passion and an intellectual curiosity to their Judaism that I've really never experienced anywhere else. And so I'm very curious to see how Reform Judaism evolves, in particular in Poland, where there's an incredible Jewish renaissance going on, but it's not a renaissance of individuals born Jewish.
Fascinating. I want to thank Rabbi Danny Freelander for a great visit here on Too Jewish. To find out more about the World Union and the work of the World Union, it's WUPJ.org, I believe, is the website. Lots of information about Jewish communities all around the world. Danny, thanks, and we will look forward to doing it again soon.
An honor to speak with you. Thanks so much, everyone. Bye-bye.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none.
from traditional services to the unique. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Lior Shrag, discussing the Jews of Nigeria. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singer Boaz Sharabi. It's the classic Sephardic song, Halavai. If only we won't abandon hope, if only we could fix this world. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Halavai. ומענן תרד עלינו קשת הלוואי שלעולם הזה יש תקנה הלוואי ויום יצמח מתוך סופה גועשת הלוואי ולא תובד לעד המתנה הלוואי שהמדבר יצמיח עשב דשא הלוואי ועוד נשב בצל התאנה